The Pharisees and some of the experts in the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus. They had observed a few of his disciples eating meals without having purified, that is to say, washed, their hands. The Pharisees, and in fact all Jews, cling to the custom of their ancestors and never eat without scrupulously washing their hands. Moreover, they never eat anything from the market without first sprinkling it. There are many other traditions they observe. For example, the washing of cups and jugs and kettles. So the Pharisees and the scribes questioned him, "Why do your disciples not follow the tradition of our ancestors, but instead take food without purifying their hands?" He said to them, "How accurately Isaiah prophesied about you hypocrites when he wrote, 'This people pays me lip service, but their heart is far from me. Empty is the reverence they do me, because they teach as dogmas mere human precepts.' You disregard God's commandment and cling to what is human tradition." He summoned the crowd again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and try to understand. Nothing that enters a man from outside can make him impure. That which comes out of him, and only that, constitutes impurity. Let everyone heed what he hears. Wicked designs come from the deep recesses of the heart. Acts of fornication, theft, murder, adulterous conduct, greed, maliciousness, deceit, sensuality, envy, blasphemy, arrogance, an obtuse spirit. All these evils come from within and render a man impure."
After the parenthesis of the last few weeks, when John's Gospel brought us our Lord's great discourse on the bread of life, we return today to the Gospel of Mark and a celebrated occasion when Jesus made an important distinction between outward behaviour and inward attitudes. The Pharisees have come from Jerusalem with some of the scribes, the experts in the law, as we heard. Jesus had been in Jerusalem recently, probably for the feast of Passover, and now he was back in Galilee, probably in Capernaum, which was his base. And these men had followed him, not because they wanted to become disciples, but in order to watch him and his followers, in the hope of catching him out in what he taught or did. They're not long in finding something to criticize.
"Why do your disciples not follow the tradition of our ancestors, but instead take food without purifying their hands?"
What might to us seem merely a reference to a lack of hygiene was a far more serious accusation of disrespect for an age-old custom, a disregard for that ritual cleanliness which had become an essential part of Jewish life, and to which the Pharisees paid an exaggerated honour. Mark, who was writing for non-Jews, the Romans in particular, goes into some detail in his explanation. "They cling to the custom of their ancestors," we heard, "and never eat without scrupulously washing their hands." "Washing their arms as far as the elbow," runs another version. Next comes the market. Now, not to eat anything from the market without first sprinkling it sounds reasonable enough. We all wash fruit, salad and other vegetables, though we might look askance at someone who insisted on doing the same to dry foods. But in other versions, the picture's a little different. "On returning from the marketplace, they never eat without first sprinkling themselves," we read in the Jerusalem Bible. And the Revised Standard Version has, "When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they purify themselves." The Vulgate has simply, "When they come from the market, unless they be washed, they eat not." The particular complaint the Pharisees make has to do with eating, with food. But if we look at the definition of the Pharisee, separated or set apart, it's hardly surprising that they would feel contaminated every time they went to the market. As one scholar comments, they thought that the market might pollute them. As for the washing of cups and pots and bronze dishes, there was apparently a whole chapter of the Talmud dedicated to that. There were phrases like these: "If someone eats bread, and this, of course, could mean any food, without washing his hands, it's as if he were going with a prostitute. And again, he who despises the washing of hands will be removed from this world. Ominous. And supposing there was no water in the immediate vicinity, what then? One must go and look for it, travelling anything up to 4 miles. So the Pharisee teachers prescribed. Knowing all this as he did, Jesus wastes no time in defending the conduct of his disciples, but goes straight to the heart of the matter. Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, and he quotes the prophet's complaint. Speaking in the name of God, Isaiah had declared,
"This people honours me only with lip service, while their hearts are far from me. The worship they offer me is worthless. The doctrines they teach are only human regulations."
And Jesus concluded,
"You put aside the commandment of God to cling to human traditions."
In Matthew's account of the same episode, he quotes the disciples as saying to Jesus in private, "Do you know that the Pharisees were shocked when they heard what you said?" But our Lord, who naturally knew very well how the Pharisees felt, told his disciples,
"Leave them alone. They are blind men leading blind men. And if one blind man leads another, both will fall into a pit."
It could easily be concluded from this exchange with the Pharisees that Jesus had no respect for tradition or commonly accepted codes of behaviour. But we find him in the Gospels reminding a Pharisee who had invited him to dinner that he had neglected to perform what was a common gesture of courtesy to a guest. A scholar reminds us,
"An important Hebrew custom was the washing of the guest's feet, a gesture of welcome in a hot, dusty country where stony roads often made foot travel a painful experience."
Back in the Old Testament, in fact, there was the famous occasion when Abraham was sitting at the door of his tent in the heat of the day, when, behold, 3 men stood in front of him. And what does he do? He offers them water to drink and to wash the dust from their feet. And the visitors, as we know, turned out to be angels. When Jesus was at table in the house of Simon the Pharisee, a woman known as a sinner came in with an alabaster flask of ointment, and recounts Luke,
"Standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, and wiped them with the hair of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment."
And Jesus reproaches Simon, who is more concerned to judge his guest for letting himself be touched by a public sinner.
"Do you see this woman? I entered your house, you gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears, and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment."
Apart from the customs of washing after contact with the unclean or before touching food, there was also the opposite, as recounted by Sir James Fraser, the Scottish anthropologist, in The Golden Bough.
"It is a common belief that the effect of contact with a sacred object must be removed, by washing or otherwise, before a man is free to mingle with his fellows. Thus the Jews wash their hands after reading the sacred scriptures. Before coming forth from the tabernacle after the sin offering, the high priest had to wash himself and put off the garments which he had worn in the holy place."
Certainly the whole idea of using water to purify the person, whether in the ordinary act of washing to cleanse the body of dirt, or in a symbolic act of spiritual purification, runs through all cultures and all religions. Nor has literature resisted the temptation to use such an act to dramatic effect, as in the sleepwalking scene of Shakespeare's Macbeth, when the guilty queen tries in vain to wash the blood from the hand that has committed murder. A waiting woman takes a doctor to observe Lady Macbeth sleepwalking, and the doctor observes how she rubs her hands. The woman answers, "It's an accustomed action with her to seem thus washing her hands. I've known her to continue in this for a quarter of an hour."
"Yet here's a spot. Out, damned spot, out, I say. Yet who would have thought the old man to have had so much blood in him? What, will these hands ne'er be clean? Here's the smell of the blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand. Oh."
Far removed from the imagination of the dramatist, in the real-life drama of the Passion, There's another scene of ritual hand-washing.
So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this righteous man's blood. See to it yourselves.
Writes a scholar.
Pilate abjures his responsibility with a typically Oriental symbolic gesture. In reality, his blame is not entirely taken away thus.
Probably no symbolic act of hand-washing is more celebrated than this. There are, of course, genuine acts of this kind, one of which still exists in the church's liturgy. It takes place at the offertory and is one of the quieter, though no less significant, moments of the Mass. After he has offered the water and wine, the priest goes to the side of the altar and washes his hands, saying to himself, Lord, wash away my iniquity, cleanse me from my sin. The ceremony originated, we're told, in the practical necessity of cleansing the fingers after handling loaves of bread, but came to signify that purity with which the sacred mysteries should be approached. When there's a server, he pours the water over the celebrant's fingers and catches it in a bowl. Until the Second Vatican Council, the priest recited part of a psalm while washing the extremities of his fingers. Known as the lavabo, from the first words he spoke, the ceremony was explained, runs a note in the old Roman Missal, by the mystical reason that one can never be pure enough to touch the God of all purity. The psalm is described as the prayer of a man of integrity, or prayer of the blameless.
I will wash my hands among the innocent, and will compass thine altar, O Lord, that I may hear the voice of praise, and tell of all thy wondrous works. I have loved, O Lord, the beauty of thy house, and the place where dwelleth thy glory. Take not away my soul, O God, with the wicked, nor my life with men of blood, in whose hands are iniquities, their right hand is filled with gifts. But I have walked in my innocence. Redeem me, and have mercy on me. My foot hath stood in the direct way, in the churches. I will bless thee, O Lord.
In a comment on the psalm, a scholar writes,
The text joins this declaration of innocence to an entrance liturgy to the temple, reminding us that the prayer is said by the priest before the great prayer of the Eucharistic canon.
Modern translations make this clear, as in this one.
To prove my innocence, I wash my hands and take my place around your altar.
Or in this.
I wash my hands in innocence and join the procession round your altar.
When our Lord accused the Pharisees of lip service, did he have this psalm in mind? The verse preceding that which opens the lavabo is revealing.
I never take my place with liars, and with hypocrites I shall not go. I hate the evildoer's company. I will not take my place with the wicked.
I refuse to sit down with the wicked, runs another version. It does smack strangely of the Pharisees' attitude and their disapproval of Jesus for sitting down with sinners. In the last part of today's Gospel, Jesus calls the crowd to him and urges them to try to understand that only what comes out of a man can make him impure. But how much the crowd understood is doubtful, as even his followers questioned him, writes Mark, when he had gone back into the house, away from the crowd. Perhaps today we think we have understood, but can we claim honestly to be better than the Pharisees? As a modern scholar comments,
The same faults could be urged against ourselves. Catholics from the highest to the lowest have been guilty of them. St. John Chrysostom was not the first or the last to say, We imitate the hypocrites, we have even surpassed them.
Perhaps we would do well to remember what St. Paul wrote to the Corinthians. Let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall.